you better have all my money, because tomorrow is the Scholastic Book Fair!
Brain Soda.
It's the Brain Soda Podcast. I, as always, am your host, Kyle, joined by my co-host and cohort, Brad.
How's it going?
Today, we're going to be talking about Greek fire. But first, Brad.
Yes, Kyle.
I want you to think about a book.
Okay, which book?
Honestly, like, probably any big name brand, young adult, or children's book.
Okay.
Because right. They're probably made, published, or distributed by our subject today, the Scholastic Corporation.
Oh, man. All right. Now, do they still do the Scholastic Book Fair?
I believe so. In a lot of different places, they still will. Now, unfortunately, there are some places that, like, Scholastic book fairs and things like that have come under fire.
What? Okay.
We may talk a little bit about that at the end.
Well, okay.
Yeah, you know.
I know that books come under fire, but I didn't know the actual book fair itself did like that. Yeah, okay.
To make a long story short, Scholastic has allowed schools to opt out of carrying certain books within Scholastic book fairs, book clubs, etc., so on and so
forth. Okay, we can get into that.
Due
yes.
to legal parameters
yes.
that they may or may not cross. So book banning, yes. But with that being said, the Scholastic Corporation was founded in 1920 in Pennsylvania, Brad, by a guy named Maurice Robinson.
Okay. Yeah. I'm surprised it wasn't Scholastic, like Bob Scholastic or something like that.
Well, it's actually really funny that you mentioned that. Because this all started, Brad, with one four-page publication. It was called The Western Pennsylvania Scholastic.
Okay.
And it was published in 1920, and those four pages were distributed amongst his classmates. Very shortly thereafter, it will cover the activities and sports of up to 50 regional high schools.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So, like this is while he's still in high school, he was doing this?
Yeah. And to be fair, like, this is, you know, a young kind of entrepreneur.
In the 20s, like, too. The 1920s. This is right, 100 years ago. Right. Yeah.
And very much so, I will say, like, while there is a entrepreneurial and business sense to this story, I want to say that, like, any company that is your stated goal and purpose, right? And there's not inherently anything wrong with that. But I will say it does kind of touch me in the fifis a little bit to know that Scholastic is a children and young adult literary first company, right? Like, yes, that is their business model, but the fact that that's their chosen business, to me, I guess, is what makes me choose them as a topic.
Well, why is that?
I believe it probably has some level of importance to them, possibly.
Oh, okay.
And it should to everyone.
Well, yeah, for sure.
So this original publication, only four pages in length, went on to birth, Brad, the largest publisher and distributor of children's and young adult books, and the leading operator of school-based book clubs and book fairs. Moving on into, like, more of the events that happen within this. So a lot of them are periodicals for a long time. And in 26, they have their first actual, like, novelization book, right? Like a prose book.
Okay.
And it is entitled Saplings. It's their first, like, offering as a prose work. We're going to fast forward because this company is obviously growing and thriving in the industry. Probably ebbs and flows like any other company. But in 1948, Scholastic partners with Pocket Books and they formed the Teenage Book Club, or TAB, as it was kind of abbreviated, right? But I think it's an important thing to note that this catered to an age range of 13 to 18-year-old high school students, right? So this is kind of baked in to Scholastic overall.
Okay.
Overall and in general, regardless of the material that's being read, because it's obviously offered to many different, you know, young adults and children all across the country, right? So the more important thing, I think, to me is that you could go in these periodicals and things like that and grab a form and order the materials you wanted, the books you wanted, and go to your educator and order through them, right? So
okay.
I think that's a cool little resource to have at the school you're likely attending every day and things like that, just right on hand. And,
yeah, that is nice.
Right, and these are all things done to incentivize interest in reading, right? Like, there's arguments that could be made about propping up personal pan pizzas later on by the time that we were growing up may not have been the best way to make avid readers out of people. But for some of us, it did.
It
right?
was. Like, it was did. A motivator.
Yeah, I was going to say, it did actually probably help a lot. But this book club idea, I think, is the ground level. And I think it's important when we talk about Scholastic and to some people who want to bring them up in political senses right here. Pre-1950, this is baked into this company. Keep that in mind. 13 to 18-year-olds able to purchase books through their teachers,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So by 1957, this company's efforts have resulted in a Canadian branch. And today, they are a multinational corporation in countless nations from China, Spain, Korea. The list goes on and on, right? Pretty much the modern world as we know it, right?
Yeah.
But 61 saw it enter the education market. And in 63, the advent of Clifford the Big Red Dog, and even today, Scholastic's logo is that very cover. And Scholastic's mascot, in large part, is Clifford overall.
Well, Clifford needed Emily, so she chose him for her own. That's the beginning of a song that my daughter was addicted to when she was about 2.5. Yeah,
I love it.
I know, I had to listen to that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet you don't anymore.
On repeat. For right. about 2 hours. So, yeah. But yes, Clifford is awesome. I do love Clifford.
Well, right. And like, I won't lie. I think a lot of other people have fond memories from my childhood of Clifford. But to know that it came from 1963 really did kind of throw me through a bit
that
of
is
a loop,
crazy.
Right, when I was doing my research.
Yeah, that is really early. Like, I mean, I thought it was like an 80s show or something like that. Well, the show was, but I know like the
right. Yeah, it's television yeah. adaptations. Yeah. And trust me, when we get a little bit later on in our segment here, there will be a litany of those that we could discuss and probably will at some point, if not in this segment right now, right? But growing and thriving in the market, like we've said before, obviously is the thing for Scholastic. And we're going to forward in time a little bit again, and we're going to go to 81. And in 81, it launched what may be the most popular brand it has outside of some of its highest grossing brands that it produces under its banner, right? That would be the Scholastic Book Fair.
Oh, okay. I was thinking for another like book series. I'm like, what book series could it be?
But yes, the Scholastic Book Fair, you know, they would bring in these giant trunks and open them out and splay them out. And, you know, as much as I hate to say it, my initial research methods kind of bore out a lot of anecdotal but highly positive examples of getting these catalogs and going through and picking out what books they wanted to get every single month, tracking what books they were reading to go get those personal pan pizzas or attend a party at the end of the month.
Oh, man.
Or all these different things.
Yes, I loved it so much.
Absolutely. These yes. books were not solely academic. You could get cheat code books. You could get how to draw yep. Marvel comics and
even
all these
toys and stuff. I'm sure it's like half toys now, but like educational toys,
well,
I'm sure.
But even then, you're right. Yeah. You could get the crazy, the turn of the millennia stuff. I remember so well. You could get the big green, gray one, aliens, inflatables, yeah. and you could get the...
I remember like the chemistry kits, and maybe like airplane stuff, maybe even like magic kits and stuff like that.
I used to get the comic book superheroes dictionaries or whatever, right? The character dictionaries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I had an X-Men one that I loved and would read all the time and just read about Mimic and all these different people who were in the 60s book because, like,
oh, man.
People didn't know that the 60s book came before Wolverine and Colossus and all the you love, right? Like, I don't know. Maybe yeah. that's why we have a podcast that is the way that it is. But, like, for real, even me... Maybe not the most astute reader ever. I loved the Scholastic Book Fair, right? I will say that now.
Exactly. It got so many people onto reading because, like, it was this crazy thing. Oh, they're coming, you know, they're going to set up this crazy fair.
A crazy, cool marketplace, right?
And look at all these crazy books. Like, there's all, you know, and, like, I don't know. I've always been a fan of, like, the feel, the look, and the smell of books and everything. So, like, to see all, you know, all these brand new books and stuff. Oh, it's the best.
No, like we talked about with John. that pulpy paper feel and smell, man, is something that it triggers certain responses in people, I guess, is the only way to say it, right? You know, I know for me, seeing something and knowing that it's kind of a relic in older comic book particular, but even if you were to pull out Moby Dick or like a first print of Cosmos for you or whatever it may be,
yeah,
for our listeners at home, like even if you weren't to get them at the Scholastic Book Fair though, Brad, there's a litany of titles underneath the Scholastic banner that we need to address, because I feel like when I go through this list, if I haven't named something that you loved as a child or love right now, you probably need to finish this episode, obviously, and go check some of them out. If you have kids, definitely do it with them, too.
For sure.
Clifford, as we stated earlier, right, the mascot of the company itself. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Babysitter's Club, Magic School Bus, I Spy, Goosebumps, Animorphs,
nice.
Captain yes. Underpants, Harry Potter, Dogman, Hunger Games, Bone underneath the graphics label, which in 2005 started to produce several different graphic novels for young readers like Guts. Just listing off all of those books right there.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like, I didn't know, like, half of those were Scholastic. That's, yeah.
And when you think about the television, film, and various other levels of adaptations, graphic novels themselves for things like Animorphs, it goes so far beyond just, you know, a single, hey, everybody, we're showing up with all these books. As a matter of fact, I didn't know for the longest time Scholastic was actually a book publisher. I thought it was like just a group that came in and incentivized reading. But later on, they kind of will delve into that even harder conceptually, because in 2006, they started making efforts into researching childhood literacy, which I think obviously is like near saintly, right? Like, you know, honestly, like it's an important thing.
That's really cool.
It does kind of sound like cliche, but like for real, I find this to be a really cool company for these reasons.
I was going to say, like, this sounds like a good company that doesn't have any scandals. I mean, maybe there is some, but
You know what? I'm sure that there are, you know what? Like, to be honest, like, let's just come out and say it. A company in and of itself is not responsible for the actions of the people at its head. That doesn't make the company overall in and yes, of itself
exactly.
evil. It makes the people responsible for those actions such and dealt with accordingly. The company becomes absolved, to be honest, right? And I'm not saying this from the rah-rah.
No, exactly. Because, I mean, what are you going to do? There's always going to be people. There's always going to be bad
right.
people.
And in any collective, there's going to be people, right? Like, and at some point, you need to just distance and disavow them. And that's just what it is. But I don't want to get into that too deeply.
Exactly. Yep.
Because the point is that I believe the overall mission statement of Scholastic, and they're delivering on it for decades is what's important here, because all of these imagination sparking, emotionally growing, mind opening, and heart wrenching stories happening before and many continuing after Scholastic's 100th year as a business in 2020.
Yeah.
Now, I noticed, unfortunately, during my research, Bradley, and if you'll indulge me, I want to take one last moment to speak on people like Kirk Cameron and various other, I don't want to say the word grifter, but I do believe that at any point, people who came out over the past year, and I saw many, really take a look at exactly what I just laid out and tell me that this is just a terrible company full of terrible people trying to indoctrinate children and bring sorrow and woe across the land. Tell me that about this company, and then propose what you propose and act it out and tell me that it wouldn't do that or worse.
Well, I just will say one thing, though. Goosebumps, man. Goosebumps was pretty scary.
And it didn't ever hurt nobody.
But it was,
how about that?
No, exactly. Go burn that's what I mean. Like, yeah, I am in total agreement with you. Like, this whole...
And it's sad. It's sad that I had to cover this and say that.
Like, exactly. Like, I cannot believe that we're actually banning books and stuff in this day and age. But, like, it's... Because this is the thing. Like, books if you're going to read a book, that, like, it's a lot different than, like, watching something or reading something online. Like, right, you know, it's a whole story, typically, you know. And, like, I feel like you should read, be able to read every single book that is out there if you want to.
I don't read, but I will say this right now. I love film and television, and I love comic books. Two mediums that adapt the written word to script, let alone use them at different points, right? I'm just saying the fact that reading aloud something that can be pictured immediately, yet it can evoke a litany more emotion because of the level of investment you have by opening that book and delving into it versus throwing on that movie and delving into it at times is what speaks volume to the written word.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, I guess the whole argument is the children, you know, you gotta save the children, protect the children. And like, obviously, I'm a parent, right? 100%. I want to protect my children, right? I want to make sure they're in a safe environment. But I really don't think books are a danger to them. Because the people that say certain books are dangerous and need to be banned are typically books where they're talking about, you know, sexuality, or
gender or race. Explicitly those three things.
Exactly. It's things like that. And really, or even like swear words, or like, okay, to go to some extreme, like, I know some people like couldn't read Harry Potter because, you know, witchcraft, right?
And Scholastic did, to mention that point, in its advertising immediately after people calling for those boycotts, they made it a point to say, okay, let's placate to them and not say magic.
Yeah.
Let's make sure everybody who's in their fifis right now doesn't hear the word they don't like.
Exactly. Like, it's just...
Like, they've catered to these people, too.
They don't... They shouldn't, though. That, in my eyes, at least. Right, because...
To an extent, I agree with that. Right, I do.
When you're at the age where you're reading these books, and, like, I mean, it goes back to, like, parenting, right? You know, you should... A parent should kind of, you know... police a little bit of what their kids are reading, but to a certain extent, like,
right,
especially when they're a teenager, they, you know, that's the time they should be reading these types of books, because that's the time they need to understand who they are and what they are, and, you know, they're growing. This is when they're becoming an adult.
Thank you for that point, because that's why I thought that book club was so important to bring up, is that
exactly, yeah,
if you're telling me that a kid who needs a, I honestly do mean this, needs a story, whether he gets it from film or whatever, but to be honest, very often in life, you're at a very young age and you're discovering yourself. And I feel like if you were to come across one of these YA books, it may save your life. I hate to say it like that.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure it has many times.
Or at the very least, let you know there's a different world.
Yeah.
Than the high school or the house you're living in where you feel like you walk on eggshells.
No, seriously.
Or like, whatever it may be, right? For real.
Books have changed my life and changed my viewpoints to the better. To the better. My own. You know, right. Like, I mean, not saved my life. I don't think a book has saved my life, but it's changed my life.
And in the land of the free.
But like, seriously, yeah.
We're talking about banning books.
Yeah, it's insane.
And from one of the most honorable companies, in my eyes, from a mission statement, I will say that, right? But my point is that for real, I can't even suggest Scholastic as a brand, because there's almost no chance that this hasn't touched you.
Yes.
As a child or as an adult.
It's like the Coca-Cola.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it is the name brand of young literature. And for that, I really do salute Scholastic. And I appreciate the extra time that you gave me here for that, Brad.
I do too. No, man, like I didn't know they were like so broad, you know.
Influential, I guess.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Like, I always just thought Scholastic, oh, you know, Clifford and the fair, right? And like, I didn't know they, like, Harry Potter and, you know, Hunger Games. You know, one thing though is that they never really had nothing about like fire. One thing, though, is that they did have a lot of history type stuff. Like, I remember one of my favorite things at the Scholastic Book Fair were those, like, I Spy or whatever. Was it I Spy?
I Spy, yeah. I was going to say that's one of the big brands.
Was it one where it had, like, ancient books and stuff? Like, it was, like, ancient things? Like, big pictures of, like, and just nice, like, pictures of all these different artifacts and all that, man. I loved that.
one of their first efforts in the educational space was a multi-text about world history.
That's awesome, though. Like, yeah, those books, like, I guarantee influenced my love of history. I can guarantee that, like, because of those books,
right?
I like history now. There's a direct, you know, correlation there. And today we're going to talk about Greek fire and the Byzantines. And I think, you know, that would have been something that would have been in one of those I Spy books, probably.
Absolutely. And yeah. And I mean, honestly, probably one of our high school or middle school books at some point or another was Scholastic.
Yeah. So yeah, let's get into it. So Greek fire was a flammable chemical weapon used in the Eastern Roman Empire. And I like to call it the Eastern Roman Empire, not the Byzantine, but I mean, it's commonly referred to as the Byzantine Empire from around the 7th to the 14th century.
Because of the capital?
Yeah, the capital. Well, and one of these days, we'll get into that.
Another day.
Yeah, another day. But we'll just say at one point, the Roman Empire was divided into two halves. Like, it was still, you know, the Roman Empire. And then the western part fell to the Goths, which were, like, Germans, right?
The Visigoths.
Yes, yeah. The Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. But, so, I mean, these were still Romans, right? And this is why Rome just fascinates me, because this empire lasted until 1453, if I'm not mistaken, when the Ottomans took over Constantinople and turned it into Istanbul, which is Istanbul, not Constantinople. Constantinople. That's nobody's business but the Turks, but today it's not going to be our business, but we're going to talk about the Byzantines, which were before then, right? Anyways, this fire would burn so hot that it could, like, melt the iron shields on soldiers and, I guess, sailors for the most part, because it was mostly a naval weapon. But
okay,
this was some crazy fire. Like, it was like ancient napalm, kind of, if you think about it. And although the exact recipe was and is still unknown because it was a closely guarded secret, like, throughout all time, it was, like, closely guarded through the state. Like, it was even, like, you know, kind of how the nuclear bomb was developed. Like, everybody only knew their own job, right? They didn't know what the other parts did or anything like that.
Right.
Yeah. But modern researchers, though, have, like, figured it out. Despite, like, you'll see on YouTube and whatever, probably History Channel and Discovery Now, you know, like, ooh, what was Greek fire? What it wasn't made out of? Let's go check it out.
Did aliens bring it?
Yeah, I hope not.
Oh, but you know that somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, they're like, it was actually given to them by the alien technology. But it was some sort of napalm. And we'll get into what it likely was. But, I mean,
it's... Wait, can I guess it really quick? Potassium.
No, and that actually was, potassium was one of the things.
Like, yeah, a blend, obviously, not straight, but
they thought maybe there might be some potassium in one of the theories of what it was.
Early. Like the disputed, yeah, okay.
So this fire, though, this fire could be, like, shot onto water and it wouldn't be extinguished, right? So it was, like I said, it was like napalm. It needed to be suffocated.
Right.
It needed to have, like, sand.
But water could not sufficiently, like, well, does water snuff out fire with oxygen? Because I thought what it was.
Well, it depends. Because, yeah, it can. But
not a lot oil of things fires, that right?
can't be exactly. Right. And this wasn't oil fire. It was like part. It was oily. It was like tar and oily.
It was buoyant enough that it would sit atop of water. Thus, it couldn't be rinsed, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, it would sit on top of the water so that it would be able to keep getting oxygen and everything. And it was sticky. You know, like this is like a sticky, tarry substance.
Right.
So it would, like, stick to you. And, oh, man, I could just imagine.
It's just like pitch.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just like, you know, like pine tar, you know, it's like, that's one of the ingredients, and they will say that, you know, like, it's in the writings, they will say that, but it's not the main, you know, it's not the secret ingredient.
Well, I could see that, right? Some sap, some potassium, some this,
yeah,
some that,
because it makes
you
it
know,
sticky.
Right?
Yeah. So the term Greek fire, though, has been commonly used since the Crusades. Like, the Europeans were the ones that kind of termed it Greek fire. But these guys, this is, like, if you know the area, this is all kind of what I was talking about with Alexander, right? This is all that Asia Minor area where, like, Greece and Turkey and even Syria to some extent, you know? Like, that area has so much, like, history and culture and everything to it. Yeah, but that's where they were. You know, they were centered in Constantinople, yeah.
It's kind of like the bassinet of civilization, right? You know what I mean? Like, so much spawns from it that it's the cradle.
It's one. It is a cradle. cradle, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, right, right, thank
you. Yeah, but these Byzantines, they originally called it sea fire, or Roman fire, or war fire, liquid fire. They had, like, a bunch of names for it, but, I mean, mostly, like sea fire was, like, what they, like, termed it a lot of the time, you know? And even though it was a chemical itself, it really should be thought of as, like, a system, because that's what made it special. Like, people got their hands, different, you know, invading armies and countries and stuff like that, got their hands on this stuff, but they couldn't figure out how to work it, because right. there was a siphon system. And the Byzantines, like, if you know, there's this term called, like, oh man, that's very Byzantine, meaning, like, it's super complex. And that's because, like,
okay.
the Byzantines, like, especially their political structure was, like, extremely complex, man. They had, like, different levels of this and that.
I haven't played them in Civ yet, but it is one of the prospects for one of my next playthroughs. Okay,
definitely do it next time. But yeah, so these ships, you know, they had these ships that carried this siphon, and it was able to, like, shoot out or squirt out this. It was special. And back then, you know, we're talking the 7th to the 14th century. This is like medieval times, right? And they had this thing that could, like, squirt out. It was a flamethrower, like a giant flamethrower, essentially.
They just squirt the pitcher. You're saying there's a live flame coming from this.
So just like a modern flamethrower, it was like, you know, a tube with this stuff. And we'll get into what theoretically.
Right. And then a separate flame held above.
And like a flame right at the end. Yeah, right at the end. And then boom.
yeah.
And they also, they used like grenades. They had like grenades.
Holy shit. Yeah, a little glass bulb. And they had bulbs.
Like mini like squirt guns of it.
Dog. Yeah,
like they also had squirt guns, which I think is funny. Like, I mean, they were flamethrowers, but like I'm sure they look like the squirt guns.
You know what? I'll be honest. That's what I thought it was more than likely to be. Two cylinders and you sucked one out and shot it. And then one guy with a torch. That's what I always kind of thought exactly. It was buckets.
Yeah.
To hear all of this, it's so elaborate and awesome. I love it.
It is. It's so crazy, man. And like, I wanted to go into some of the battles, but like, we could be here all day talking about the battles. And one of these days, we'll talk in the future about some of the good ones.
The Best of Greek Fire, Volume 1.
Yes. Yeah. So most of the accounts of Greek Fire, though, were like secondary sources, or more often than not, like just misinformed or lying and stuff, because like people didn't want to talk about it. Even the military manuals, there was a lot of Byzantine military manuals, which were like sweet. Like, I didn't know they had these. They were like kind of like the art of war. Like, it was like a, you know, Byzantine art of war, but it's like, you know, how to like mostly attack in like Persia, because like they just fought the, or you know, the Arab nations, the Middle East, right?
Right,
they fought
right.
them like constantly until actual like Islam took over, you know, like that's really what ended up taking over the area. But so one of the more accurate sources of this fire, though, was from this woman named Anna Komnene. And I hope I said that right. I've listened to so much of this one podcast about the Byzantines, and the Komnenes are like a big, you know, family.
Oh, then
and,
I think you, know, like, you got it.
Alexius.
I believe in
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's hard. It's Komnene. But, or at least, you know, in English. But Alexis was her father, and he was like a big, you know, he was a big emperor. He ruled for a long time and all that. And this woman, though, like, man, she, like, you know, it's kind of cool because, like, at this time, this was, I think, in the, like, the 12th century, if I'm not mistaken. Like, she wrote this Alexiad, which was, like, this very historic and very, it was, like, a biographical book about her dad. And I think in, like, her brother, you know, that was ruling at the time. And like, it's cool to see that, right? You know, to have that first account, you know, that firsthand account, and by a woman, nonetheless, right?
Right, right.
So she writes a partial recipe for the concoction, and she says, I quote, "This fire is made by the following arts. From the pine and certain such evergreen trees, inflammable resin is collected. This is rubbed with sulfur and put into tubes of reed, and is blown by men using it with violent and continuous breath. Then, in this manner, it meets the fire on the tip and catches light and falls like a fiery whirlwind on the faces of the enemies."
Wow, that is poetically sick. That's yeah. It's so metal. Yeah. I love it.
It is.
I just want to hear that as a song. Like, if we could get some downbeats on that
stat. Man, I bet you there is something like that. You know, some, like, metal or something talking about the freaking...
Some Iced Earth record somewhere.
Yeah. Because, the Russians, actually, there was a battle with the Russians where Greek fire was used. The Rus, which were, like, early Russians, which were from, actually, Ukraine. And there's this whole thing. You know, actually, it... has to do with the war going on currently in 2024, you know, with Ukraine and Russia.
The motherland type.
Yeah, that's part of the reason. But anyways, this is another story. But yeah, so from this, you know, if you listen to the quote, you know, that she's talking about the pine and there's certain trees, you know, this pine tar they take and they put it in these tubes.
Right.
And then it's blown by men. So like they're using like bellows to, you know, heat it up.
Okay.
They're heating this liquid up though. So like, from other sources and from this, you know, like we can say, like, ascertain, like, three things or, like, three main points.
Right, infer maybe, right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That it burned on water and was, like, even ignited by some other sources.
Okay.
And that, like, it had to be smothered or, like, some sources say that it could be put out by, like, vinegar or old urine. So maybe, like, ammonia. Maybe it was, like, a caustic thing then maybe because it was acidic.
But another chemical resource.
Exactly.
And not water. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, pretty much that was an indistinguishable, you know, like, water doesn't put it out is the main thing. Like, you know.
Okay. Right.
The second thing was that it was liquid and not a projectile. You know, so like.
Right.
It was,
right. Probably an important distinction, right? And especially in the times, like, what's comparable to grenades at this point?
Only in, like, China.
Right. And that's glass, isn't it? Or is it like an actual grenade?
I think so.
Okay.
Well, China had fireworks almost.
Oh, like, they didn't, okay.
Like, really
okay.
Had, like, fire, you know, like, yeah. But yeah, so. And then also that it was usually ejected from a siphon. But it could also be used in grenades, like you said. The last thing, though, is that it was accompanied by a thunder and a lot of smoke, right? So, like, a loud, like, bang and smoke.
Okay.
And I don't think, like, the bang was probably just, like, the things being released, you know? Or, like, I think it's just, like, a hiss, and they say it's thunder. But maybe not, you know? Maybe because, I don't know, yeah.
There's no telling besides audibly hearing it happening. But I would assume
exactly
that no matter what, the initial lighting... is an immediate violent exothermic reaction, and thus a loud clatter happens across. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, like a whoosh.
The
yeah,
air.
That's true. Like a yeah, whoosh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, boom, yeah. That's probably what it is.
Yeah, because they probably like made it spray. They probably figure out a way to make it like, you know, spread, like, you know, you put it on your, you're not your mist setting, but you know, you're you got your garden hose and you're setting it on whatever your spray setting so that it doesn't.
Like, or dreams meeting together.
Exactly. Yeah. So that it doesn't, it's not like a chunk of water. It's not a stream. It's more of like a, you know, like they can make it like a wall of fire, or maybe they had different nozzles and stuff, you know. I know they did, like they put like lions and stuff at the heads of the nozzle, so it's like a lion breathing fire. Like back then, man, that had to have been crazy just to see that type of stuff.
Oh yeah. And imagine being the first encounter of.
Yes, exactly.
You know, imagine being the first people to survive and have to tell the rest of your tribe or whatever it would be like. So what did they do? Well, they came in with all this paste, right? All right, what's the big deal?
They burned us down.
Then a giant fire happened. What? Yes.
Yeah, they were throwing fire out of their ships, yeah. Okay, so, like, there was the siphon on the ships, right? And it was also used in sieges, though. And when it was used in sieges, they would, like, dip, like, buckets, you know, and then light the buckets on fire or drop them. Or the portable projectiles, though. Like I was saying, the super soakers, I like to call them. They were, they were chrysophones, I think is, like, how you say it in Greek.
Okay.
But they were reputedly invented by the Emperor Leo VI, and I think he was also a big emperor. Again, like, this is, you know, over 1,000 years of history. There's tons of history about these Byzantines. That,
right,
like, man,
right.
I love it. I love how the Romans lasted that long. You know, they're still Romans. They thought themselves, they were always called themselves Romans. Like, they never stopped thinking they were the Roman Empire. So, this is going on from what? You know, pretty much 43 B.C., to 1543, CE.
Man, wow, yeah, that's crazy, yeah. Dude. I mean, it is and it isn't, because we know of Rome in such forlorn tale that, like, it just seems like a stat to a certain extent, but to take it all in, like...
But it just goes on. It just goes on and on.
No, that is right. That is, like, up until... I don't even want to say the dawn. It is the dawn of Western civilization, right?
Almost till the discovery, yeah. Until they find America, yeah. Like 40 years before they find America. It's insane. But yeah, anyways. Anna Comnene, she also wrote in the Alexiad describing the contraption as, quote, he, meaning the Emperor Alexius, knew the Pisans were skilled in sea warfare and dreaded a battle with them. On the prow of each ship, he had a head fixed of a lion or other land animal, made of brass or iron, with the mouth open and then gilded over, so that the mere aspect was terrifying, and the fire which was to be directed against the enemy through tubes he made to pass through the mouths of the beast, so that it seemed as if the lions and the other similar monsters were vomiting the fire.
Wow, dope. Metal AF.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I just love to see that would be crazy.
But, well, right. I mean, not even that. Like, obviously, to hear it again, the power of verbiage, right? Like, to hear it detailed out in the written word is a really cool experience. Yeah. But yeah, I could only imagine what it would be like to have a bird's eye view and just see raining fire in a battle.
Yeah. Sea or land. Ships on fire. Like, exactly. The ship fire. That's just crazier to me, man. It's just like, yeah.
But even beyond that, could you imagine seeing people mount up ladders to the side of a castle wall and get 3/4 of the way up and a flaming bucket drops down on them one by one by one, and the ladder's burning and the people trenching at the bottom are burning. The sea fire would be dope, but I feel like it'd be quick.
It would be.
They're on mostly wooden boats, sails. Dog, everybody's dead, and that thing is burning into ash and sinking into the ocean within hours.
Yeah.
This can go all night long, depending on how many people are running up them ladders or trying to.
Well, years. Sometimes, yeah, month. I mean, depending on how the siege works. But yeah. But yeah, so to get into, like, I mean, the thing with the ships, though, is that it's this contraption, man. Like, that is really what, to me, is really crazy. Because they had, like, this pressurized system and everything, right? And the way they think they did
it. Yeah, this is pre-indoor plumbing.
Yeah.
And they're making flamethrowers.
Yeah. You can look up, like, what artist renditions of what they think it is, you know, and all that. But essentially what they think it is was a large furnace under a copper pot full of the mixture, right? So there's this copper pot that's, like, pressurized and sealed up and full of the stuff, because the stuff's thick, right?
Right, right.
It's a tarry substance. It's got to be heated up to get moved.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, street tar, it's exactly. Probably heated up, right? Yeah.
So they heat it up, and then they have a pump with a nozzle that shoots it out. And
oh, well, that's where you get your stream.
Exactly. Well, the pump, I mean,
that's how you adjust it to spray or not.
Pressurizing this stuff, right? Like, that's the big thing, is that you're, like, because you're heating up and pressurizing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that shoots it out, right? And then it was probably burnt, like, it was heated by using linen or flax, like cloth, right? Because they didn't have, like, wood. Right. They didn't want to bring wood on the ship. Or much, you know, you don't want to bring a bunch of wood because it's heavy.
Right.
And also, it might burn slower, maybe, or a different way if you have, like, certain things, like, soaked. And it burns slower at a lower temperature, maybe, or something like that. So, that created a bunch of smoke, though. So, there's your smoke. Yep. That's the reports of the smoke, more than likely. And once the liquid's heated, though, like I said, it's pressurized. And the valve on the pump was then opened, and then it comes shooting out of the nozzle. And the tip of the nozzle, like I said, had a flame at the end, and it also was on a pivot, so it could, like, move back and forth.
Oh my god, this is so efficiently deadly.
Yeah, it is.
Like, think about that, because I'm telling you right now, I can see it.
I mean, he's that modern day. You can use it in, like, a modern day war, you know, in, like, a tank.
Absolutely, and be highly efficient.
Yeah,
right.
It's just napalm. It's napalm, man. Like, that's such
right.
Yeah,
right.
So for the longest time, though, they thought saltpeter like scholars, you know, European scholars thought saltpeter was what, I guess, like from the 1700s, 1800s on, you know, they're like, it had to be saltpeter, you know, this is gunpowder. But it couldn't be because gunpowder wasn't brought to Europe until the 13th century, even into the Middle East until that time. And they thought it was because of this thunder and smoke. But obviously, like I said, the linen and the flax burning was what made that more than likely. And maybe it probably burned too, because we'll get into what it is. Like this stuff burn, like it's smoky when it burns. So, you know, that's obviously will burn, you know, make a lot of smoke.
Right, yeah. Right.
And another theory was that it was from quicklime. And other ingredients like that, you know, like what we talked about going back to the periodic table, you know, when you mentioned phosphorus, right, like these things right. that are reactive with water, maybe, you know, calcium or phosphorus or sodium or something like that. But the thing is, the direct accounts and the evidence suggest against that, because if it was if it was made with that, it would ignite at that point, because Greek fire was poured on the wet decks of ships, right? You know, like the decks of ships get really wet. But they would also pour it on there to like light the ships on fire. So you get like, there's not like, if it would had the quicklime, or the thing that's reactive with water,
it would ignite that. Once it contacted the water. Yeah. Right.
And also they counted grenades too. I guess they can make some like crazy grenade where there's like half, you know, Greek fire, half water or something, and then throw it. That would be kind of cool if it was.
I could see that a second bulb inside of the first, and then once the one goes, the other but one's I don't think they were that. It's a thinner glass.
It wasn't that, and it was never glass. It was mostly like bronze. It was like bronze grenades they threw.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But at least, you know, the Greek fire was. But also, they've done like modern experiments where like they've made things with quicklime and things like that. And it just didn't work like that. You know, the way those alkaline metals react with the water, they like kind of explode.
Right.
You know, they don't really catch fire. They're more of like it's an explosion type thing, right?
Instantaneous, right.
So it couldn't be that. But modern scholars, this is what they've probably thought, and what more than likely it was, is this stuff called naphtha, or also known as crude oil.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Because, I mean, yeah, obviously they didn't have internal combustion engines at this time, right?
Right.
But there was things like the Beverly Hillbillies where, you know, there's just some oil spurting out of the ground.
You would get a geyser,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of those, and there is still a lot of those around the Black Sea. That's why Russia, you know, wants a lot of control of that area and things like that. And also throughout the Middle East, right? We're talking the Middle East. You know, the Middle East that's the whole reason why America is in the Middle East right now.
Yeah. And was during most of our adolescence.
Exactly, yep. So, like, they probably had access to these natural naphtha springs or wells, if you want to call them that, right? And from that, they probably use that with this pine tar, right? They mixed this stuff or refined it a little bit to make it more flammable.
Thicken it up, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, if you know, like, crude oil, if it burns, you know, you've seen, like, oil fires and stuff like that. It's like this black smoke.
It can burn for days.
Right, and it burns for days, too, yeah. But it's black, it's like this thick black smoke. You know, that might be the smoke from the freaking...
Right.
And there's the counts, like, to support this, right? In the 6th century, even, this is before Greek fire was invented, there's this Greek historian named Procopius that he talks about this Persian oil that they called Median oil, that was used by them to, you know, burn things, not as a weapon, but in the 9th century.
But though, a fuel source for burning, right?
Exactly, yeah. And in the 9th century, the Abbasids, which were like the rulers of the Middle East at that time, you know, like the Persian empires and all that. Yeah, they had special troops called the Naphtun, but they were like, you know, flamethrower troops, kind of like they had, you know, they had squirt guns too, man.
Okay.
They had some squirt guns.
Right.
Well, they had copper containers that they threw, not squirt guns. Sorry.
To me, it's the two-cylinder squirting mechanism, right? Like, it seems like a simple enough design.
Oh, yeah. That's how I think the squirt guns were, or something like that. Like a little tube, like a little, you know.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But like I said, though, it was these tars and resins that really were like the mix of that, what made it special. You know, because you could heat it up and it was sticky, and like they just refined it to the perfect thing. And like from that, like they were able to, like, you know, save their city with the other things, you know, but against the Rus, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that like saved their city by burning down that naval battle. which, yeah, we'll have to get into one of these days. But I don't know.
Definitely. Yeah,
it's awesome, man. I love Greek fire. it's such an interesting thing, you know, like such a cool weapon. Flamethrowers back in the medieval times.
No, it is. And like, right. And like, I won't lie. This is one of the things that when I knew we were going to cover, I was like, oh yeah. Like that level of excitement of familiarity, because like it is, it's so metal. It's such a cool advent and war use in the time of that it like permeates, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, to even hear you lay it out now, it's so much more technologically advanced than even I remember.
Yeah, the engineering of it.
Like, it's awesome, right? Yeah,
the engineering is so crazy.
It was a really cool time to hear you talk about it, man. Sure. And to hear about some of these battles I would really like to do.
Definitely.
And if you have something you would like to hear us cover, why don't you let us know? You can reach us on our social medias, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, on Patreon, where you can now find our episodes both early and unedited. Give us a rate and review on your podcast platform of choice to help out the show. For Brad, I'm Kyle, and we will see you again here soon.
See ya. Brain soda.